So I've been in this chapter on the practices and perspectives, and I read an excerpt from Majjhima 70, which is in a sense of the need for a gradual training, gradual practice, gradual progress. And the Buddha saying, I do not say that final knowledge is achieved all at once. Having read that excerpt, I began reading the whole sutta because I thought it was an interesting sutta showing some of the historical realities of the Buddha's establishing of the Sangha and Sangha life, where sometimes people followed what he was teaching and training and sometimes not. So it happens even with the Buddha himself. And then I'll continue the sutta where we left off. I'll read the last verse just before I left off. I say of such bhikkhus who are in higher training, whose minds have not reached the goal, and who are still aspiring to the supreme security from bondage, that they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when those venerable ones make use of suitable resting places and associate with good friends and nurture their spiritual faculties, they may, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. Seeing this fruit of diligence for these bhikkhus, I say that they still have work to do with diligence. And then we'll continue on. Bhikkhus, there are seven kinds of persons to be found existing in the world. And there's a footnote on that. Here follows a sevenfold classification of noble individuals which categorizes them not merely on the basis of their path and fruit attainment, as the more familiar Eightfold Scheme does, that's practicing on the path to stream entry, stream enterer, on the path to once returner, on the path to non-returner, non-returner, on the path to arahantship, and fully awakened arahant. That's the most well-known model of realizations that the Buddha teaches. But according to their dominant faculty, alternative definitions of these seven are offered in a commentary. And there's not a whole lot of description in the suttas. So then it gets to the commentaries to tease it out, and sometimes they clarify it and sometimes they muddy the waters. What seven? They are one liberated in both ways, one liberated by wisdom, a body witness, one attained to view, one liberated by faith, a Dhamma follower, and a faith follower. What kind of person is one liberated in both ways? Here, some person contacts with the body and abides in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, and his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. This kind of person is called one liberated in both ways. I do not say of such a bhikkhu that he still has work to do with diligence. Why is that? He has done his work with diligence. He is no more capable of being negligent. And the Pali for that, Ubattubhaga Vimutta, so he's liberated both ways because he's liberated through the immaterial attainments and through wisdom. So through insight and through the higher refined aspects of the immaterial attainments in meditation. What kind of person is one liberated by wisdom? Here, some person does not contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial. That is, they're not so skilled in the really refined aspects of meditation. Transcending forms, but his taints are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. This kind of person is called one liberated by wisdom. I do not say of such a bhikkhu that he still has work to do with diligence. Why is that? He has done his work with diligence. He is no more capable of being negligent. What kind of person is a body witness? Here, some person contacts with the body and abides in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, and some of his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. This kind of person is called a body witness. I say of such a bhikkhu that he still has work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when that venerable one makes use of suitable resting places and associates with good friends and nurtures his spiritual faculties, he may, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, here and now enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. Seeing this fruit of diligence for such a bhikkhu, I say that he still has work to do with diligence. So some person contacts with the body, abides in those. So this person is conversant with the immaterial jhanas, four jhanas, and then the immaterial attainments, but only some of his taints are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. So probably non-returner, once-returner could have those attainments. Okay, from the commentary, this type includes the six individuals, one established in the fruit of stream entry, up to the one established on the path of arahantship. But the commentary stresses that it's one or other of the immaterial attainments, including cessation, is needed to qualify as a kaya sikin. What kind of person is one attained to view? Here, some person does not contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, but some of his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom, and he has reviewed and examined with wisdom the teachings proclaimed by the Tathagata. This kind of person is called one attained to view. So this is somebody not so skilled in the refined aspects of meditation, and then some of the taints are destroyed. The commentary says this type includes the same six individuals included under the body witness. So from the stream enterer to the one on the path of arahantship, but they're without the possession of the immaterial attainments. And then it goes on to define him as one who has understood the Four Noble Truths and has reviewed and examined with wisdom the teachings proclaimed by the Tathagata. And then what kind of person is one liberated by faith? Here, some person does not contact with the body and abide to those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, but some of his taints are destroyed by seeing with wisdom, and his faith is planted, rooted, and established in the Tathagata. And that's called the Saddha Vimutta. And this type includes those same six, sort of defined basically in the same way as the one attained to view, but adds that they've not reviewed and examined the teachings with wisdom so much. There's just a tremendous amount of faith. And what kind of person is a Dhamma follower? Here, some person does not contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, and taints are not destroyed, but seeing with wisdom. But those teachings proclaimed by the Tathagata are accepted by him after reflecting on them sufficiently with wisdom. Furthermore, he has these qualities: the faith faculty, the energy faculty, the mindfulness faculty, the concentration faculty, and the wisdom faculty. This kind of person is called a Dhamma follower. And then the Buddha is saying, I say of such people, he still has work to do. So this is called a Dhamma Anusarin. And similarly, as well as the following, has basically the same definition, but the predominant quality is faith. What kind of person is a faith follower? That's a Saddha Anusarin. And they're individuals on the path to stream entry, the former with the predominance of wisdom, the latter with the predominance of faith. So that they're sort of on the path. I just thought it's an interesting template for realization. It only comes up a few times through the suttas. After going through these different types of attainments, Bhikkhus, I do not say that final knowledge is achieved all at once. On the contrary, final knowledge is achieved by gradual training, by gradual practice, by gradual progress. And how is final knowledge achieved? By gradual training, gradual practice, gradual progress. Here, one who has faith in a teacher visits him. When he visits him, he pays respect to him. When he pays respect, he gives ear. One who gives ear hears the Dhamma. Having heard the Dhamma, he memorizes it. He examines the meaning of the teachings he has memorized. When he examines their meaning, he gains a reflective acceptance of those teachings. When he has gained a reflective acceptance of those teachings, zeal springs up in him. When zeal has sprung up, he applies his will. Having applied his will, he scrutinizes. Having scrutinized, he strives. Resolutely striving, he realizes with the body the supreme truth and sees it by penetrating it with wisdom. And then he addresses those bhikkhus who weren't really keen on following the training that the Buddha set down. He says, there has not been that faith, bhikkhus, and there has not been that visiting, and there has not been that paying of respect, and there has not been that giving ear, and there has not been that hearing of the Dhamma, and there has not been that memorizing of the Dhamma, and there has not been that examination of the meaning, and there has not been that reflective acceptance of the teachings, and there has not been that zeal, and there has not been that application of will, and there has not been that scrutiny, and there has not been that striving. Bhikkhus, you have lost your way. Bhikkhus, you have been practicing the wrong way. Just how far, bhikkhus, have these misguided men strayed from this doctrine and discipline? So sometimes the Buddha could be pretty tough. Bhikkhus, there is a four-phrase statement, and when it is recited, a wise man would quickly understand it. I shall recite it to you, bhikkhus. Try to understand it. And then the commentary says the four-phrase statement is the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. However, no mention is made here of the four truths. Possibly the four-phrase statement is the resolution on effort just below, with each clause counting as a phrase. There's a lead-up and a bit of a digression or something. Venerable Sir, who are we that we should understand the Dhamma? Bhikkhus, even with a teacher who is concerned with material things, an heir to material things, attached to material things, such haggling by his disciples would not be proper. If we get this, we will do it. If we don't get this, we won't do it. So what should be said when the teacher is the Tathagata, who is utterly detached from material things? Because for a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, it is natural that he conduct himself thus. The Blessed One is the teacher. I am a disciple. The Blessed One knows. I do not know. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation is nourishing and refreshing. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, it is natural that he conduct himself thus. Willingly let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, and let the flesh and blood dry up on my body. But my energy shall not be relaxed so long as I have not attained what can be attained by manly strength, manly energy, and manly persistence. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, one of two fruits may be expected, either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So anyway, I thought that was an interesting sutta. Any questions? Yeah.
Root is defined quite clearly, but path, I've not read so much on how path is defined, and then the relationship.
Exactly. There is not a succinct definition of it, other than, you know, of course, Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, Five Spiritual Faculties, Seven Factors of Awakening, the kind of standard foundations of the practice, or the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. for right efforts, for basis of spiritual accomplishment, five powers, five faculties, seven factors of awakening, four foundations of mindfulness, eightfold path. So those are all bases of practice that the Buddha says culminate in insight. So there's, yeah.
Just in terms of the path, as I think we read it in there, as I kind of have understood it before, is that the faith follower and the Dhamma follower are considered to be on the path.
They're considered to be on the path to stream entry.
Yeah, so they're the very first attainment.
That's the first attainment. Yeah. So the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings that we chant, that confuses everybody. Those who are on the path to stream entry, a stream enter, those who are on the path to the other four attainments. So there's kind of an undefined dividing line between somebody who is a kind of interested or kind of practicing and who are actually on the path for stream entry, for realization. And it's not really defined at all. Or not that I've found.
I think, I mean, it's not a real explicit definition, but they have faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha.
Yes.
And a modicum of understanding, wisdom understanding.
Yeah.
Something like, yeah, kind of.
It's squishy.
It's squishy.
It's squishy. Yeah. Which is, you know, quite the reality. I mean, it's sort of, how do you define it? Absolutely, solidly. Because it's, as I said, Ajahn Chah saying, yeah, the language of Dhamma is language of feeling. So it's, you just have to get a feeling for that kind of commitment and that commitment to the training. Yeah?
You mentioned that Zagata is a bit harsh in discipline. And I wonder, what is the practical side of it in my own thoughts? Is it because the times were a bit evoking the military services, or is it a personal gain or society to be in alignment with spiritual?
I think different people respond to different forms of encouragement, and different people can respond in different ways at different times. Trying to follow a template is actually maybe not the wisest thing to do. You just follow, just be compassionate and really try to encourage people. And you think, God, they just need to be hit over the head with a 2x4. It's just, you don't get their attention otherwise. So it's sometimes there's, you know, circumstances sort of dictate and personalities dictate. I certainly watched Ajahn Chah. You know, he was a real master at dealing with different people and incredibly skilled. And, you know, sometimes he could be, you could never predict how he would be. And you'd think, oh, wow, you should be really careful because, you know, Lopo Cha is really going to bite your head off. Then you see him respond in this incredibly kind and solicitous way. And at other times, he'd be a real taskmaster. So there's a certain trust that comes with, okay, so somehow they've got a feeling for it. I know for myself, sometimes I don't think it through how I respond to people. I don't have a plan. Oftentimes it's just circumstances elicit something. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Yeah.
On that topic, there's another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. I think it's the shorter discourse on the cowherd simile, which presents almost the same material, but in a very encouraging tone. That you can read them side by side and realize it's not the material, it's the audience.
It's the people that he's teaching. Oftentimes, you know, he's really responding to people. That's where it's really helpful to have these suttas that are, on to a certain degree, they try to keep everything. Like you read Mahayana suttas, and the Buddha's astounding, and lights are going off, and different universes are being awakened and enlightened, and everything's incredibly fantastic. But there's a flavor to it that is consistent. Whereas in the Pali suttas, there's not that same consistency. I mean, there's a consistency in terms of the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, dependent origination, but the flavors, there's multi flavor. Okay, so back to the island, and I enter into another subsection in this chapter, and I title it A Natural Path. And that term came up in this sutta, that sense of there's a certain naturalness to a progression of practice or insight or training or accomplishment. So that's what this next section will be. So there is a naturalness to this gradual training. The cultivation of the basic qualities leads naturally to more advanced qualities. For example, one of the common ways of teaching the training fundamentals is to emphasize the qualities of generosity, virtue, and meditation, dana, sila, bhavana. And there's many different templates through the suttas. When one is generous and delights in giving, the heart tends to be satisfied and joyous. This supports the cultivation of virtue and integrity, as a heart that is satisfied and contented easily inclines to restraint and composure. With this composure, together with the lack of remorse that virtue affords, the heart is easily settled and focused. Meditation thus progresses more smoothly, and the mind naturally brightens, making it suitable for seeing things as they truly are. It is helpful to recognize this tendency for good qualities to foster further good qualities, so that we can nurture the appropriate causes for the results we are seeking. Otherwise, we can be prone to wanting to experience the fruits of the training before the ripening has fully taken place. An image Venerable Ajahn Chah frequently used was that of a person tending an orchard. His or her duty would be to prepare the soil, fertilize the earth, water it, and keep the bugs away from the tree. Not to pull on the tree to make it grow faster, or expectantly stand there waiting for the fruit to miraculously appear. When the duties have been fulfilled properly, fruit will appear in accordance with its own nature. Again, a sense of naturalness of the process. This next excerpt is from a sutta called the Meghya Sutta. It shows up in two different places in the canon, one in the Anguttara 9, Sutta number 3, and in the Udana, these inspired utterances. I think Ajahn Amaro told the story of it when he was doing the readings.
I can't remember how much of it he read, but there was a
reference. Right. Meghya was attending with the Buddha, traveling with the Buddha, just the two of them together, and then Meghya goes on alms round, sees this nice little grove, and thinks that'd be a great place to go and practice and meditate. And he asks permission from the Buddha to go, and the Buddha actually says, "No, wait, I'm on my own right now. Wait for a bit." And Meghya says, "Well, I really want to go, and I'm really keen on practicing, and it's okay for you to sort of not practice right now. If you're fully awakened, I've still got work to do." Anyway, so it goes back and forth and makes his request three times, and finally the Buddha sort of said, "Okay, well, go." And of course he goes, but then his mind is a mess. He's constantly overwhelmed by thoughts of sensuality, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming, the three forms of wrong thought, in Miccha Sankappa in the Eightfold Path. So then comes back to the Buddha with his tail between his legs and says, my mind's a mess, I don't know what to do. And the Buddha then instructs him. Meghya, while the heart's deliverance is still unripe, five things lead to its ripening. What five? Firstly, a bhikkhu has good friends and companions. Secondly, a bhikkhu is perfect in virtue, restrained with the patimokkha restraint, perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing fear in the slightest fault, he trains by giving effect to the precepts of training. Thirdly, he is one who finds at will no trouble or reserve such talk as is concerned with effacement, as favors the heart's release, as leads to complete dispassion, fading, ceasing, pacification, direct knowledge, enlightenment, nibbana. That is to say, talk on wanting little, on contentment, seclusion, dissociation from society, energeticness, virtue, concentration, understanding, deliverance, knowledge, and vision of deliverance. Fourthly, a bhikkhu is energetic in abandoning unwholesome things and in giving effect to wholesome things. He is steadfast, persistent, and untiring with respect to wholesome things. Fifthly, a bhikkhu has understanding. He has the Noble One's penetrative understanding of rise and disappearance that leads to the complete ending of suffering. Now, when a bhikkhu has good friends and good companions, it can be expected of him that he will be virtuous. It can be expected of him that he will be one who finds at will such talk as is concerned with effacement and so on, that he is energetic in abandoning unwholesome things and in giving effect to wholesome things. It can be expected that he has the Noble One's penetrative understanding of rise and disappearance that leads to the complete ending of suffering. But in order to become established in those five things, a bhikkhu should, in addition, maintain in being these four things. Attention to the unattractive aspects of the body, so asupa, should be maintained in being for the purpose of abandoning lust. Loving kindness for the purpose of abandoning ill will. Mindfulness of breathing for the purpose of cutting off discourse of thoughts. Perception of impermanence for the purpose of eliminating the conceit I am. For when a person perceives impermanence, perception of not-self becomes established in him. And when a person perceives not-self, he arrives at the elimination of the conceit I am. And that is Nibbana here and now. So that's an incredibly rich collection of advice and contemplation, just the things to be attending to. Again, to facilitate this natural maturing or a natural growth, as in the image of Ajahn Chah, is looking after, preparing the soil, fertilizing the earth, watering the plant, keeping the bugs away from the tree. And it'll give fruit in its own way, depending on its nature. In the sense, if you plant something like tomatoes, it doesn't take very long and you've got a tomato showing up. But if you plant a coconut, it takes about 15 years, I think, to finally get fruit from the tree that you've planted. You still have to look after them both, but it depends. Yeah, we're all different kinds of plants, and we're just looking after ourselves in the appropriate way. And when one has laid down those conditions of kalyanamitta, good friendship and virtue and appreciation of that sort of integrity and attending to one's precepts and being very cautious with speech. I mean, it's really easy to dissipate. And you see that in the winter retreat, going to the temple, being in your room, practicing, and then you get distracted by some conversation with somebody about something that's completely irrelevant to living a peaceful, wise life, and it just reverberates for days. And it's just really ordinary. So it's just really paying attention to speech and putting forth effort, but it didn't have to be astoundingly heroic in the energy, but just being, yeah, just not being lazy. Just being consistent is really, really important. And that contemplation of understanding rise and fall, things coming into being and ceasing. And then with those five things established and, you know, having tools in one's tool belt for approaching the ways that the mind is getting itself distracted or going into places that just aren't fruitful. And it's always getting lost in sensuality or just getting lost in the world, the sense world. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, the world of fantasizing and proliferation. It's coming back to something tangible, the body, and paying attention to the hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin, all these different aspects of the body, 32 parts of the body, or just picking up one or two here or there that just make things tangible. Paying attention to loving kindness. We can always justify irritation and aversion and ill will towards somebody because why not? It's completely acceptable. But no, it's just from the Buddhist perspective, it's you don't get lost in ill will or aversion for any reason whatsoever, even to the point bandits are cutting you limb by limb with two-handed saws. You know, as they said, somebody who arises a thought of ill will is not practicing my teaching. It's about as powerful a statement as you're ever going to get. And mindfulness of breathing for dealing with discursive thought, the mind proliferating. Again, coming back to the body. People try to solve the problem of their dukkha with their unruly mind by trying to think their way through it. And good luck. It's just not going to happen. Come back to the body. Get an anchor. Get a foundation. And then, of course, this very powerful statement of that contemplation of perceiving impermanence is a doorway into this perception of not-self. And establishing that sense of not-self, that the elimination of that conceit, I am, seeing not-self incredibly clearly, that is Nibbana here now. That is the awakening right there. The Buddha's giving us the key. Any questions? Yes.
I have impression from Ajahn Chah teaching that he more concentrate on direct realization, which is a practice of meditation, and he also not recommend to reading so much, but reading our mind. And recently you just mentioned this 37 faculties of the tools that we use to purify our mind and even attain the jhana. And again, as a lay person, it's a long study to go through that. Is it enough for us as a lay person? We just have the practice of being here now, then do meditation.
Being here now is great if you here and now has some structure to it. In the sense of, if you're in the here and now, I remember Ajahn Chah, Paul Breiter is asking the question. He sees when Paul had left the robes, and then it would be 1979, and then Ajahn Chah came here to England, of course, to visit the Sangha here, and then went to America and taught. And Paul had been out in the world for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, and had been practicing in different places and meeting different people. And he said, you know, I've got a friend of mine who's a Dhamma practitioner, and he says his best meditations are when he's doing rock climbing, because he's completely in the present moment and his mind is really clear. And Ajahn Chah sort of laughed and says, while he's climbing rocks like that, is he contemplating the Four Noble Truths? You know, because it's one thing to be in the here and now and be present, but are we turning our attention to the process of how do we attach and get tangled up in our wrong views? Because there's fundamentals of wrong perception, of thinking that what is impermanent is actually permanent, thinking what is actually dukkha is pleasant or is gratifying, thinking what truly is not self, this is me and mine, this is what I am, and then thinking what is actually, you know, really fundamentally unattractive is really desirable. So that getting hooked by that. So it doesn't take a whole lot of, doesn't take a whole lot of study, and it doesn't take a whole lot of technique, but it does need a focus on what's really important. Sometimes just having enough knowledge for that is what I think Ajahn Chah is really pointing to. And also, he was teaching people who have a fundamental, they have a fundamental confidence and faith in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, a fundamental, a really strong Sadha and faith, and for the most part, especially as monastics, most of the monastics have already completed at least a few grades of study before going to stay with Ajahn Chah, so that they've got enough. And certainly for us Westerners, we showed up with way too many ideas. But it is helpful to get the right information and to be able to apply that skillfully. Because sometimes just being mindful and peaceful and thinking that if I'm just in the present moment, then it's going to awaken me. It's a, you know, there needs to be a catalyst. We have to challenge the mind. And that's where the structure of the teachings is really important. And having tools that we can challenge the fundamental delusions that we tend to be caught by. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Another question is, here we are practicing meditation, would also a kind of understanding come naturally via meditation?
Not necessarily. I've been around for a long time. I've seen a lot of meditators. It requires a willingness to reflect and investigate. The two fundamental things that the Buddha points to, qualities that are essential for liberation and accomplishment of liberation. First thing is kalyanamitta, having good spiritual friendships. And it isn't just a sort of hang out with nice people, but spiritual friendships in the sense that one is getting good information, one's getting a good mirror of one's own knowledge and understanding, and being introduced to knowledge and understanding that is of real benefit to one. Of course, there's the supportive aspect of a spiritual friendship in the sense that one is encouraged, but then there's the other aspect where one is learning from other people who are have dedication and have a good knowledge themselves. The other aspect that the Buddha points to is yoniso manasikara, so wise reflection, skilled attention. One is an external quality, one is an internal quality. Yoniso Manasikara, it's a theme that comes up over and over again because there's this need to direct attention in the most efficacious way, the most efficient or most useful and beneficial way. And similarly, for the mind to be peaceful, of course we want the mind to be peaceful, and the Buddha encourages the mind to be peaceful, but we have to learn how to use that peaceful mind. Because in the end, what is needed is relinquishment. You know, we don't let go of anything very easily. I don't know who the writer was who said, "All that I ever let go of had claw marks on it." It's a great description of what our mind does.
When I think of Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Sumedho, who talks quite strongly about the goal and realization and the wisdom, the years and decades of following precepts, of sense restraint, of moderation in eating and sleeping, all the gradual path stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of sometimes doesn't get talked about as much as the, the more profound meditation and, it's just how embody that.
Yes, yes. They definitely embody that, and they're pointing to what is essential, but their own lives are the examples of what is needed. And, it's like Ajahn Sumedho spending this first full year in solitary meditation, reading one book, The Word of the Buddha. It's a small book, and it's all about the Four Noble Truths. And just having that structure, reflecting on that over and over and over again. And that was incredibly powerful for him. Having some kind of structure for the mind to be able to reflect on its experience. So it's important.
Having kids, it's a big structure to reflect upon.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking of the Buddha teaching us. He was not always gentle and compassionate. And any mothers who've had children, you realize different children have to be treated in different ways. And then the same child, they don't respond in the same... So you're always having to adapt. Okay, it's almost 7 o'clock. We'll wrap it.